In the year 1519, there was a notable event that took place in the university city of Leipzig in the German states, part of the Holy Roman Empire. For 2 years, there had been debate raging across Europe over Martin Luther's 95 theses that he posted in Wittenberg on October 31st, 1517. That's the reason that we designate October as Reformation Month. But in 1519, there was sponsored at the University of Leipzig a debate. Now, the debate ostensibly was between a Roman Catholic theologian of very high reputation, John Eck, and one of Martin Luther's colleagues at the University of Wittenberg, a man named Karlstadt. They were the opponents, ostensibly, in the debate. Actually, though, John Eck wanted to debate Martin Luther, But because of some ground rules that were established, Luther was prevented from speaking, or was advised not to speak. But in the course of that debate, John Eck turned aside from Karlstadt, whose performance was somewhat wooden, and asked Luther if Luther himself would take up the challenge. One of the points of the challenge was that Luther should comment on whether or not he and those who were standing with him were Hussites, that is, followers of John Huss of Bohemia, who had been burned at the stake just over 100 years before. Luther at first denied that charge, but then during the lunch hour, instead of going and having lunch, he went to the university library and got out the record of the Council of Constance and the proceedings there against John Huss. And he read some of the things that Huss himself had said and written. And he came back to the debate after lunch and said he wanted to revise some of his earlier remarks. And one of the things he wanted to revise was to strike his denial of the charge that he was a Hussite. He said, I am most certainly a Hussite. Well, this was tantamount to admitting that he was a heretic in the eyes of the Roman Church. But one of the major impacts of that debate was that there were many people there from the academic world around Europe, including some from England and Scotland. And they listened to the debate, and they took Luther's ideas to areas from which they had come, outside the German states. And so, either through those direct contacts or through other intermediary contacts, people in other lands began to hear the ideas of Martin Luther. So it was not just confined so much longer to Germany. And when they heard those ideas, they thought, he's talking the truth. He's speaking the truth. Now, in Scotland, those ideas found a prepared audience. And the reason for that was that God had prepared the way in Scotland over a century before, in the late 14th century, through the preaching of a band of men who were called the Lollards. These men had been trained by John Wycliffe, and they had gone out with the scriptures that Wycliffe had translated from the Latin into English. Now, already in Scotland, there was a distrust of the papacy. That distrust was fairly common knowledge. And there was the lack of any emphasis on the impact of the gospel on the soul in terms of the ministry of the average parish priest. So the people of Scotland were yearning for something that was genuine. Now, the authority with which Luther and his colleagues preached, and the authority with which, for example, Patrick Hamilton, of whom you heard last Lord's Day evening, the authority with which these people preached was completely different from that which most of the people were used to hearing. The parish priests did not preach in that way. It was, in some ways, like the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ. When he began to preach, and he did not preach as the rabbis or the scribes. So the movement that began in Scotland in the 1520s reflected, in its early phases, the Lutheran character of the early Reformation. Now, you can appreciate, I think, how God was moving. Calvin was still a boy, and Knox was not much older. The first adherents of the Reformation in Scotland did not have then many of the theological distinctives that would be the marks of those who came later. This Reformation followed a much later track in Scotland. There were a number of reasons which I will try to detail for you. But what those people did have, though they didn't have all the theological training, they did have the passion and the commitment, the desire to the preaching of the Scriptures. That is, not to preaching the Roman Catholic calendar, but preaching the Scriptures. And that is one of the hallmarks of true Protestantism. Now, the Reformation in Scotland faced fierce resistance. That was true everywhere, from the entrenched leaders of Romanism. And in England and in Scotland, there was an additional layer of resistance. That was in the person of King Henry VIII. Now, King Henry VIII was the King of England, but he was able to project his influence into Scotland through alliances with Scotland's royal family called the Stuarts. Now, it was the determination of Henry VIII that he would not allow any Lutheran ideas, and they did not call these people Protestants at that time, they called them Lutherans, he would not allow any of those ideas to come into his land. How he was going to keep them out when there were boats that could go back and forth between England and the continent is hard to say. But he wrote a strong treatise in defense of Romanism. And the Pope was so impressed that he named Henry VIII Defender of the Faith. Now, the papacy came to regret doing that before too many years passed, because when Henry's own interests in terms of who he would marry and divorce superseded those of the papacy, then he became interested in opposing papal authority. But Henry's real effectiveness in suppressing Lutheranism was in the area north of the border. He had a strong ally in the King of Scotland, James V. And in the years that preceded the death of James V, and he died in 1542, there was a clear policy of opposing Protestant ideas wherever they appeared. Heretics were to be rounded up and handed over to the secular government to be tried, but the trials were just showpieces. The result of the trials was already determined. If you were accused of being a heretic, as would be the case in the Spanish Inquisition, you had two choices. You could admit the charge that you were a heretic and recant. Or you could admit the charge and not recant. You couldn't say, no, I'm not guilty. If you were accused, you were guilty. And that was the case in Scotland. So that the purpose of apprehending somebody was really to impose capital punishment. And in most cases, that's what happened. fires blazed all across the land. But in spite of all the opposition, the Reformation found its most fertile soil in Scotland and its greatest success as well. Scotland would become the source of Protestantism in Ireland, and ultimately it would influence heavily the colonists who settled in the Appalachian areas of North America. So the Scottish Reformation first furnished not only the closest to an ideal theology and the most scriptural form of church government, but also the model for truly representative government in the civil sphere. The liberties espoused by the Scottish reformers in 16th and 17th century Scotland became the touchstone of American patriots in 18th century North America in their struggle for independence from the British crown. So there's every warrant for saying that the American way finds its roots in the soil of Scottish Presbyterianism. You may recall that last year, in our series of messages on the life of Calvin, we ended with a message that in which I called Calvin the father or the founder of America, and that his ideas regarding government were the foundation of the organization of this country's government. So for the first time, there was espoused in the Scottish Reformation the principle that the state does not control the church. That became an accepted reality. Now, we think of that and we take it for granted, but I want to tell you this idea was revolutionary. It was so revolutionary that for generations afterward, the kings tried to undo that very idea. The Reformation in Scotland had two distinct phases, and with the first phase we're going to be concerned this evening. That phase began in the 1520s and continued almost to the end of the 16th century. And the second phase began, and we'll deal with this phase next week, God willing, the second phase began with the signing of the National Covenant in 1638. And the struggle that followed that event that continued for 50 years, the period known as the Covenanting Period, or sometimes the Killing Times. We'll deal with that, God willing, next week. Now, the shadow of John Knox looms very, very large in Scotland and across the whole of the Reformation. But the first phase is the phase that he influenced personally and through his successors. And we are concerned with that this evening. In the Bible reading that we have done in Hebrews 11, we saw the descriptions, especially in the words of our text, of those who out of weakness were made strong. Well, that's the story of the Reformation in Scotland. People who out of weakness were made strong. Knox spent a year and a half lashed to an oar in a French galley ship and was made to provide the propulsion for moving those ships. Out of weakness, he became strong. So I want this evening to give our attention to Scotland's Reformation, Phase 1. In this first phase of Scotland's Reformation, there are four key figures, and each played a particular role in advancing that work. You heard last week about Patrick Hamilton. I wasn't here, and it could be that some things I say will overlap with what you heard last week. But you heard about Patrick Hamilton, who was burned at the stake in 1528. He was really the first one to bring the message of salvation by grace alone to Scotland. His legacy was through the influence from Luther and his doctrines. He was the first of the figures. The second was George Wishart. George Wishart was burned at the stake in 1546, which was also the year that Luther died. And he exemplified the extent of the suffering that was going to have to be endured in the establishment of the Reformation in Scotland. John Knox was the third figure. John Knox did not perish at the stake, although it wasn't for lack of trying on the part of those who hated him. John Knox died in his own bed in 1572. And he personified the strength of character, the resolve of will that was needed to prevail in the battle against the forces of Romanism. And after his death, the fourth figure, Andrew Melville, of whom we'll have more to say later on in this message, became known for working to take what Knox had done and to consolidate it so that the Reformation became a settled fact in Scotland. Now let's deal with each of these figures in turn, and do not spend as much time with the first three as we will with the fourth, for I find him a most interesting figure. So first, let us deal with the concept of salvation. That was really crucial in the ministry of Patrick Hamilton. Hamilton brought the teachings of Martin Luther to Scotland not long after Luther had appeared at the Imperial Diet at Worms in 1521. And it is a fact that after that appearance, when the emperor branded Luther an outlaw and said basically anybody who comes across Martin Luther has full authorization from the emperor to put him to death on the spot, and no one will say anything about it. Well, after that time, Luther mysteriously vanished. He disappeared from view. And for a long time, not even his friends knew what had happened to him. He had supposedly an imperial safe conduct, so when he disappeared, everybody assumed the worst, and they thought, well, there you go again. The emperor has not kept his word, just as he did not keep it to John Huss over 100 years before. But actually, the disappearance of Luther had been orchestrated by one of the electors of the empire, who was Luther's own prince. The Elector Frederick of Saxony had arranged for Luther to be abducted on his way back from the appearance at Worms. And the elector gave very specific instructions that he was not to be informed as to who did the abduction or where it was done or what happened to Luther afterward. But arrangements were made to take him to a castle in what is now eastern Germany called the Wartburg. And there Luther went into hiding for more than a year. He grew a beard. When he appeared in public, he disguised himself as a knight. And it was while he was out of public view that Patrick Hamilton was preaching Luther's ideas concerning salvation by grace alone in Scotland. And the message that he delivered was very direct. There could be no salvation apart from true justification. We were speaking of justification this morning. So it was not on the basis of human works. And that set Hamilton at direct loggerheads with the Roman establishment. For they were all about human works. This was the whole point. What could be done with penances and masses for the dead and all the rest of it if salvation, if justification, was not on the basis of human works? But Hamilton emphasized it was on the basis of the work of Christ alone. Now the effect of Hamilton's ministry was overwhelming. It's hard for us to imagine. People who live today, they can't even comprehend it. But there were many souls. When they heard that message, they said, that is the message I need to hear. They had been going all their lives faithfully to the services of the church. They had been taught that if they were faithful from the time of their births to the time of their deaths, that they would be granted absolution at their deaths, and that their time in purgatory would therefore be shortened. That was the prospect that they had throughout their lives. And when they heard the preaching of Patrick Hamilton saying, you can know that you're saved, not on the basis of what you have done, but on the basis of what Christ has done, they deserted the church in droves. And don't think that wasn't noticed. That development spurred the Romanists into action. They observed the defections from their services. And so the word went out that Hamilton must be stopped. Those were the details that I presume you heard of last week. He was arrested. He was accused of being a heretic, which was the same thing as being condemned as a heretic. And he was burned at the stake in 1528. But there was, at the scene of Patrick Hamilton's burning, a particular eyewitness. And he is the second of these four figures. So we come now to this aspect of this phase of the Reformation in Scotland, suffering. The eyewitness to Hamilton's death was a priest by the name of George Wishart. Now, ostensibly, he was in sympathy with the church's position against Hamilton. But as he watched Patrick Hamilton go to his death at the stake, he was so impressed by Hamilton's demeanor, he thought, how can he be demonstrating this kind of demeanor, that he thought, I'm going to look into the ideas that Hamilton has been preaching. I'm going to investigate Lutheranism for myself. So he began to study Luther's writings. Now, as a priest, he had access to the scriptures, and he had access to other things that had been published, things that the people in the churches had no access to. So he began to study these things, and he compared them with scripture, and he found there was no variance between what Hamilton had been preaching and what the scriptures taught. But what sealed his mind in this regard was the opportunity he had to go to Germany to be a student at the University of Wittenberg and to study under Martin Luther. When Wishart came back to Scotland after studying under Luther, he began to preach himself the doctrines of the Reformation. Now, so we're talking now from 1528, now we're in the 1530s, the mid to late 1530s. There are still many people around who had heard Patrick Hamilton. Now, as a result of his death, perhaps they had withdrawn a little bit, but they heard Wishart preaching the same things, and they were ready to listen to him. So many people began to gather to hear this man as he preached, often outdoors, for he couldn't gain the location of the church to do this preaching, and many souls were delivered from Romanism. And they came to know the joy of salvation. So here was, I often think about the ironies involved in this situation. Here the church put Hamilton to death, and they thought that by that action, they had put an end to the proclamation of the gospel. But one of their own adherents, one of their own priests, in witnessing that act, was led then to study the doctrines of the gospel and became a preacher of them himself. So the very effect that they sought to stop, which was the desertion of many adherents from the services of the church, was revived. Now, the reaction of the Papal Party meant that the Reformation would have to face real suffering. Wishart was arrested in 1546 and condemned to be burned to death at the stake. And that was carried out under the watchful eye of Cardinal Beaton in St. Andrews. If you go to St. Andrews, you can see the place where Wishart was burned. At least that's what people tell me who have been there. Cardinal Beaton was the most visible face of Roman Catholic oppression in Scotland. Eventually, Cardinal Beaton became the target of the rage of the Scottish people, and he himself was brought out of his castle dwelling place, and he was beaten to death. And to this day, they talk about Cardinal Beaton being beaten. And in that way, the people of Scotland demonstrated that they wanted to hear the doctrines of the gospel. Now, just as there had been an eyewitness to the death of Hamilton, there was an eyewitness to the death of Wishart. And he was a man who had become one of Wishart's proteges. His name was John Knox. And that leads us to the third of these four figures in this phase of the Scottish Reformation. Strength. Salvation, suffering, strength. Now, what can we say about John Knox? 5 years ago, we did a whole series of messages on the occasion of the 500th anniversary of his birth. But let us say that he was prepared of God in a remarkable way to bring strength to the work of the Reformation. There needed to be a leader who would be resolute in the battles that were bursting upon them. Knox had been prepared in a singular way to lead this aspect of God's work. He was a fearless man. That is, his experiences had been such that he could not be intimidated. He had spent a year and a half in a French galley, rowing up and down. He knew what it was to suffer pain, so he wasn't really going to be intimidated by the threat of more suffering. He was equipped to resist every effort to bring him under the authority either of monarchs or prelates. Here was a man who stood face to face with Mary, Queen of Scots, when she was barely 20 years of age and was said to be one of the most beautiful women in Europe. He stood face to face with her and refused to be intimidated even by her tears, professing his submission as a subject of hers. He said, nevertheless, it was not her business to dictate what would happen in terms of the worship of God in the church. Knox had been trained by John Calvin in Geneva. And he took that training and he made the Kirk of Scotland, if you will, the Church of Scotland, the laboratory for the implementation of Calvin's ideas to a far greater extent than had been accomplished anywhere else. And in Scotland there came to be the brightest expression of that system of doctrine and government that the world had yet seen. Now, under his ministry, there was another man who was prepared to lead the Reformation. That man's name was Andrew Melville. And so we come to the fourth of these aspects, settlement. Melville was a man fully in the spirit of Knox. He was a man who spent very little time, relatively speaking, in the company of Knox, at least when you compare him to Luther and Melanchthon and Calvin and Beza. But Melville was a man who was dedicated to preserving the legacy of Knox's ministry as a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He was a man who understood there was only one head of the church, that is Christ. So by the efforts of Andrew Melville, and he really, I believe, is one of the unsung heroes of the Reformation, especially in Scotland, because by his efforts in refusing the efforts of the monarchy to overturn the work of the Reformation, he helped to win for every Presbyterian congregation after his time a right that we take for granted, the right to elect its own minister, its own elders, its own office bearers. That is something that we take for granted. But Andrew Melville was the one who won that right. The right to have all church matters resolved in the presbyteries and synods and general assemblies composed of elected representatives from every congregation, not by the king. There is a sense, then, in which we are here this evening as a Presbyterian congregation because of the work of Andrew Melville in Scotland. Now, there was one incident from Melville's life that conveys the spirit of the man better than any other. In 1596, so this would have been 24 years after the death of Knox, there was yet another attempt to restore bishops to Scotland, episcopacy. And that was a backdoor attempt to bring the Roman Church back to power in Scotland. So the Protestant ministers went down to the Palace of Holyrood. The Palace of Holyrood is at the lower end of what is now called the Royal Mile. It's a street about a mile long. Goes from a low point on one end of a raised ridge all the way up to the other end where you have Edinburgh Castle. Well, they went to the palace to argue against this betrayal of the Reformation. Now, the King of Scotland at this time was James the Sixth. He was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. He had become King of Scotland when he was 6 months old. James the Sixth would, not too many years after this time, become James the First, King of England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. He was 30 years old in 1596, and he had always thought very highly of a man named James Melville, who was the nephew of Andrew Melville. And so as a result, James Melville was selected to be the spokesman of the Protestant Party. In a scene described by J.A. Wiley in his History of Protestantism, James Melville spoke only a few words in the hearing of the king when the king interrupted him violently and denounced him and the others as inciters of sedition. Here was the tactic. You people are teaching the subjects to rebel against the authority of the king. Well, in the midst of that outburst, James's uncle, Uncle Andrew, Andrew Melville, stepped into the fray. And he took the king gently by the sleeve, and he called him God's silly vassal. And then he addressed him with these words that I read from Wiley's account. Sir, we will always humbly reverence your majesty in public, but since we have this occasion to be with your majesty in private, and since you are brought into extreme danger both of your life and crown, and along with you the country and the church of God are like to go to wreck for not telling you the truth and giving you faithful counsel, we must discharge our duty, or else be traitors both to Christ and you. Therefore, sir, as divers times before I have told you, so now again I must tell you, there are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. There is Christ Jesus, the King of the Church, whose subject King James the Sixth is, and of whose kingdom he is not a king, nor a lord, nor a head, but a member. We will yield to you your place and give you all due obedience, but again I say, you are not the head of the church. You cannot give us that eternal life which even in this world we seek for, and you cannot deprive us of it. Permit us then freely to meet in the name of Christ and to attend to the interests of that church of which you are the chief member. Sir, when you were in your swaddling clothes, Christ Jesus reigned freely in this land in spite of all his enemies. His officers and ministers convened for the ruling and the welfare of his church, which was ever for your welfare, defense, and preservation when those same enemies were seeking your destruction and cutting off. And now, when there is more than extreme necessity for the continuance of that duty, will you hinder and dishearten Christ's servants and your most faithful subjects, quarreling them for their convening, when you should rather commend and countenance them, as the godly kings and emperors did? And from the report of those who were there, the effect of this bold address, you have to say that that was certainly bravery. The effect of this address is that the king backed down. He calmed down. And he allowed the Protestants to continue in the path that had been charted for them. Melville was always deeply conscious of the presence of Christ as the King of the Church. And I would that we would be conscious of that very thing. We gather here tonight. This is not my church. This is not the church of anybody else here. This is the church over which Christ reigns. He is the King of the Church. I think it would transform our worship if we took it into our minds that when we come into the house of God, we are coming to do reverence to the King of the Church. Melville strove then all of his life to defend the honor of Christ's throne in the Church of Scotland. He denied any secular power the authority to intervene in the Church. He would say, we must never tolerate the secular power telling us what we can preach or how we must conduct our business. That was maintaining the crown rights of Jesus Christ. Melville struggled against the philosophy that was prevalent in that time that was known as Erastianism. And that was the philosophy that the government has ultimate authority in the church. And I want to tell you, there are a lot of disciples of that philosophy that are still around, and many of them are in positions of power. This philosophy held that the government can reverse church decisions and even install its own choices as rulers in the church. So what Melville did was to take what Knox had done and to codify it, to consolidate it, to make sure that the Reformation would survive in the generations that followed. So in his work was the model for the functioning of Presbyterianism, both at the church level and at the national level. We should make no mistake about it. The idea of representative government that we enjoy was rooted in the Scottish Reformation. The idea that people elect their officers in their churches and charge them with the responsibility to make decisions, that is the genius of the Scottish Reformation. What was the theme of this work? It was to stress two things. The finished work of Christ. No need for masses. No need for reenactments or perpetuations of the work of Christ on the cross. The finished work of Christ and the liberty of the Church of Christ to follow the King's direction, the King's commands. This is the legacy that was left to us by the reformers in the first phase of Scotland's Reformation. It was a legacy that would be sorely tried in the second phase of that Reformation, to which we will come in due course in the next week in the will of God. But I want you this evening to reflect upon how great the blessing of God is to you, that as a result of the sacrifices and the courageous stands that those men made without knowing what the outcome was going to be, as a result of that, you have the liberty to attend in freedom the worship of God after the due order, to sit in a church that has the liberty to elect its own minister and its own officers. For that we give thanks to God, for the work that was accomplished in the 16th century in Scotland, that from the sacrifices of Hamilton and Wishart to the leadership of Knox and Melville, a work was done that by the grace of God, though Scotland has turned its back on that work, that work has been preserved in other places and continues to this very hour, even here, in this very place. May God be praised for all that He has done in those days.